Chapter 38. The Iraq-Iran War. Another EHM victory. Nassim came back to me 30 years later. On a June night in 2004, I was soaring above the Middle East, headed for Qatar, a stop-off point for changing planes on my way to Nepal and Tibet. Located across the Persian Gulf from Bandar Abbas, Qatar was a country I had barely heard of during my EHM days. Peering through the window, I watched the sunset over Greece, Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. I thought about my grandmother. The long winter evenings when she read to me from the Odyssey, the Arabian Nights, and the Bible. My plane passed over the islands where Homer's adventurer roamed and toward the mountain where Noah had built his ark. We entered the airspace above a magical land that was the home of Babylon's hanging gardens, humanity's first cities and farms, and our earliest written language. Below me was where the wheel and modern mathematics were invented. I recalled the stories that had captivated me about the fortresses attacked by Richard the Lionhearted and defended by Saladin. Then my thoughts focused on Nassim. It had not taken much time, a blink in history, for his prophecy to become reality. I myself had written a book exposing the deceits he had described. His Iranian dictator king had fallen, replaced by radical mullahs. Israel had grown even more aggressive, and the United States had supported her every move. The Palestinians suffered and showed others like bin Laden about the power of a single person wearing a homemade bomb. The United States had demonstrated its brutality in 100 unknown places and a few known ones, Panama, Haiti, and Sudan. Then came 9/11, Afghanistan, and Iraq. After so many years on this planet, we humans had failed to wean ourselves of the compulsion to subjugate and slaughter our brothers and sisters. Gory crusades were not relegated to the past. I felt exhausted, overcome by a profound sense of discouragement. The whole world had watched the United States launch what Muslims called a new crusade, when stealth bombers invaded Iraq for the second time in little more than a decade. Yet, although shock and awe elevated military violence to new levels of horror, from my point of view, it was simply the next predictable step in Washington's plan to dominate Middle Eastern guardians of the world's largest oil repository. Controlling or destroying Saddam had seemed an inevitable consequence of my own EHM successes in Saudi Arabia. Throughout the 1980s, Washington supported Saddam's war on Iran. Not only was he our vehicle for revenge against the Ayatollahs, who had deposed the Shah, stormed our embassy, humiliated American hostages, and expelled our oil companies, but also he sat atop the world's second largest oil reserves. The EHMs went to work on him. We gave him billions of dollars. Bechtel built him chemical plants that we knew would produce sarin and mustard gas for killing Iranians, Kurds, and Shia rebels. We provided him with fighter jets, tanks, and missiles, and trained his military to operate them. We pressured the Saudis and Kuwaitis to lend him $50 billion. Watching events unfold in Iraq, I often thought back to the words of that Iranian engineer who escorted me and the other two main employees from Kirman to Bandar Abbas. "Iranians are not Arabs. We're Persians, Aryans," he had said. "The Arabs threaten us. We're with you guys 100%. Suddenly the tables had turned. The Iranians had become the bad guys, and an Arab named Saddam was our ally. The 8-year Iraq-Iran war was one of the longest, costliest, and bloodiest in modern history. By the time it ended in 1988, more than 1 million people were dead. Villages, farms, and the economies of both countries were devastated. But the corporatocracy had enjoyed another victory. Military suppliers and contractors profited handsomely. Oil prices were up. Throughout, the EHMs tried to convince Saddam to accept a deal similar to Sama, the one I had helped forge with the House of Saud. They wanted him to join the empire. But Saddam kept refusing. If he had complied, like the Saudis, he would have received our guarantees of protection as well as more U.S.-supplied chemical plants and weapons. When it became obvious that he was entrenched in his independent ways, Washington sent in the jackals. Assassinations of men like Saddam usually have to involve collusion by bodyguards. In the cases I knew personally, Ecuador's Roldós and Panama's Torrijos, I was certain that bodyguards trained at the United States School of the Americas were bribed to sabotage the airplanes. Saddam understood jackals and their techniques. He had been hired by the CIA in the 60s to assassinate Qasim and had learned from us, his ally, during the 80s. He screened his men rigorously. He also hired look-alike doubles. His bodyguards were never sure if they were protecting him or an actor. The jackals failed. So in 1991, Washington chose the option of last resort. The first President Bush sent in the U.S. military. At this point, the White House did not want to take Saddam out. He was their type of leader, a strong man who could control his people and act as a deterrent against Iran. The Pentagon assumed that by destroying his army, they had chastised him. Now he would come around. EHMs went back to work on him during the 90s. He did not buy their package. Once again, the jackals failed. A second President Bush deployed the military. Saddam was deposed and executed. Our second invasion of Iraq sent the strongest possible signal to Islamic militants. They knew that 9/11 was simply a justification, that the hijackers were not connected to Saddam or Iraq. They also understood that the Christian right strongly influenced U.S. politics, had aligned itself with the Israeli lobby, and was determined to subjugate the Middle East and control world oil supplies and transportation routes. The Arab response was predictable. From the days of lion-hearted King Richard of England to President Bush, Arabs have made two things very clear. They want, one, Europeans and now Americans to stay away, and two, their own forms of government, for the most part based on Islamic law, rather than our concepts of secular democracy. Middle Easterners never forgave Europe for arbitrarily imposing borders on tribal lands and crowning kings friendly to their distant regimes. Resentments that began in the Middle Ages grew over the centuries. Many Arabs believed that the new post-World War II empire, led by the United States, had designs similar to those of the Crusades. The more savvy among them, like Nassim, suspected from the beginning that Israel was more than a haven for a suffering people. When Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion proclaimed the birth of a new state on May 14, 1948, Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, and Lebanon immediately attacked. During the ensuing years, Muslim distrust seemed justified by the United States' uncompromising support of a country that, through a succession of wars, grabbed more and more territory from them. They were incensed by the deal we EHMs cut with Saudi Arabia and by the subsequent westernization of that country, home to Islam's most sacred sites. The 1991 invasion of Iraq and the United States' high-profile military presence following it supported the theory that the West was continuing a tradition introduced by medieval European zealots. The second invasion was, for Middle Eastern Muslims, an intolerable affront. It conferred on Arab militants a new legitimacy. In the eyes of many around the world, they were transformed overnight from terrorists to freedom fighters, and those who saw them in this new light were not restricted to the Muslim world. My despair mounted as I thought about the escalation in weapons and its implications for the Middle East. Ours is a world bristling with arms like never before. The corporatocracy thrives on an economy that depends on manufacturing military equipment. Our arms companies rank among the world's most profitable businesses. Combined with those of the UK, France, Russia, and Brazil, their sales approach $900 billion annually. Today's chemical, nuclear, and biological arsenals along with the more traditional ones, may boost economies. However, they also threaten mass murder. Arms consumption has reached global addiction levels. A country's political status is often measured by the size of its armory. The corporatocracy has managed to link the business of selling death with international diplomacy. Example: Israel and Egypt each receive billions of dollars every year from Washington because they participated in the 1978 Camp David peace accords. As a part of this peace deal, they must earmark a large portion of the money they are given for purchasing U.S. military equipment. Darkness enveloped my plane, and I thought about the change in geopolitics since the time of that trip with Frank and James from Kirman to Bandar Abbas. We traveled down that ancient desert caravan route as the Vietnam War was ending. After that, the Middle East became the arms industry's primary testing ground and market. And later, when the Cold War ceased, Islamic revolutionaries replaced communists as justification for escalating the war machine. A rudimentary knowledge of history made all this, and the commercial motivations behind it, seem extremely obvious. I wondered how so many educated people could be deceived into believing that the current struggles were about defending noble ideals. The EHMs and media moguls excelled at providing disinformation that translated greed and domination into liberty and democracy. They served the corporatocracy magnificently. By the time my plane landed in Qatar, I had been flying for nearly 24 hours. I was exhausted and jet-lagged. I certainly was not prepared for the man I was about to encounter. Chapter 39. Qatar and Dubai. Las Vegas, in the land of mullahs. I staggered into the Qatar terminal, disoriented. Glancing around, I was stunned to discover that the place resembled a modern shopping mall more than the Middle Eastern airports from my EHM days. The people themselves provided the only link to that past. At least a few of them did. The groups of men in their long traditional robes and keffiyehs, and the women in their hijabs. Waiting in line to buy an ice cream, I struck up a conversation with a man in blue jeans, a polo shirt, and sports coat. He turned out to be a real estate developer from Los Angeles. Responding to my amazement about the airport, he said, "Most people focus on the violence in the Middle East. However, there's another side. You see it right here in this building, although it's nothing compared to what you'll find in Dubai. The financing for much of that violence comes out of the countries on this side of the Persian Gulf. The billionaires' club. Pure capitalist materialism. Pure gluttony." He grinned broadly. "My kind of people. Turns out Muslims are pretty much like everyone else. They love diamonds and gold and Rolexes and Mercedes. These Arabs may talk a big story about living ascetically, following Allah's commands, not charging interest on loans, keeping their women veiled and so forth, but just look around. They sure as hell aren't practicing it." We arrived at the counter. He insisted on paying for my ice cream. We wandered through a sea of tables that could have been a food court in an upscale mall anywhere in the United States and sat down. He was eager to talk. "Dubai is it. The big enchilada among all these other tacos," he said, trimming the ice cream at the edges of his cone with his tongue. "Nothing like it in the world. The Arabs are playing Allah, bringing in hundreds of thousands of workers and humongous bulldozers to excavate, drain, dam, and dredge the sea. Dubai is expanding faster, higher, and bigger than any other country on Earth. It's got an 80-meter indoor ski slope, the world's tallest hotel, and soon it will have the world's highest building." He was now attacking his cone, as though his words drove him into a feeding frenzy. "Fancy this. Dubai is home to the world itself. Hundreds of man-made islands, each representing a country or region. The whole thing extending 5 miles wide and 5 miles long out into what was once the Persian Gulf. A real estate developer's wet dream." He finished off his cone and wiped his hands along his jeans. "You think Allah's boys don't like their booze and women? Think again. In Dubai, anything goes. The best scotch, gambling, women, drugs, prostitution. You got money, you buy anything you want. Anything. As our plane took off from Qatar, the stars illuminated the Persian Gulf. It was a night like the one I had experienced in Bandar Abbas. I wondered whether that long wharf where I had met Nassim was still there, somewhere below my plane. Peering into the darkness, I saw nothing. I recalled that at the end of my time as an EHM, President Carter's political future had revolved around Iran. The Shah, the man Nassim detested, had fallen. The U.S. embassy was occupied, the 52 hostages were at center stage, and the president had tried to boost his waning polls by declaring that any attempt by militants to gain control of the Persian Gulf would be interpreted as an assault on the United States. Such an attempt, he declared, would be repelled by military force if necessary. Carter's threat had not been idle. He sent Delta Force to extricate the hostages. The maneuver ended in tragic failure, but now I understood that the United States' overall Middle Eastern policy, especially its support of Israel and the deals it had struck with the critical Arab governments in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Egypt, had accomplished something even more vital to the corporatocracy's interests. Although our overt policies in Iran and Iraq seemed a shambles, in a more subtle way, we had co-opted the Arab world once again. In Dubai, we had sold them the world. Like China, the Middle East had bought our form of materialism. The plane suddenly banked. A flurry of lights appeared beneath my window. Bandar Abbas. I looked for that wharf. Then I realized that this cluster of lights clung to the southern edge of the dark gulf, not where Bandar Abbas was located at all. I was looking at Dubai, at a place that could not have been detected from a plane at night the last time I visited this area. It too had been a sleepy village. Now, it was the world's most grandiose shopping mall, ski resort, casino, and entertainment center. I craned to take it in, to try to comprehend this paradox. The brainchild of Arabs who espouse traditional Islamic beliefs and have built a new type of Mecca that mocks the original. Below me, a monument to excess that Cleopatra and King Tut might appreciate. But Osama bin Laden? I recall the comment Maine's President Jack Dauber had made to me that night he and his wife invited me to dinner at the Hotel Intercontinental Indonesia regarding oil as the new standard for establishing the dollar's sovereignty. He had been right. Then he had turned to his wife and remarked that the U.S. is launching a new period in world history. He had been right about that, too. But now, a quarter century later, that period was already fading. Something entirely different was emerging. Chapter 40. Into the Abyss. For many years, corporatocracy policies appeared successful to businessmen like Maine's Jack Dauber. However, events that later unfolded in Asia and Latin America have exposed those policies as failures. They propelled Asia into the 1997 economic crisis, elevated China to a global leadership role while opening it to an orgy of materialistic gluttony modeled after our own, and drastically expanded the gap between Asia's rich and poor. In Latin America, our actions relegated millions of people to destitute lives, undermined an aspiring middle class, and finally empowered indigenous and nationalistic uprisings that brought a new wave of anti-corporatocracy leaders to power. Yet Washington denied culpability for its failures. The newspapers, magazines, and airwaves were flooded with reports that blamed corrupt foreign government officials, religious fanaticism, and left-wing dictators for all the problems. The corporatocracy and its agents were painted as the good guys, intent on promoting democracy. Seldom was it mentioned that we were the ones who corrupted those officials, that our repressive policies empowered the fanatics, or that many of the Third World's leaders we classified as dictators were actually democratically elected, often by greater majorities of voters than U.S. presidents. Through the concerted efforts of politicians, corporate executives, and a collaborating press, the breakdown in U.S. foreign policy, at least in Asia and Latin America, was hidden from most citizens. The failures, however, were obvious in the Middle East. Even before the invasion of Iraq, it was apparent that the corporatocracy had lost control and that EHM strategies had backfired. Violence was rampant, anti-Americanism transparent. Kermit Roosevelt's scheme led to blowback when, in 1979, militant nationalists dethroned the Shah. U.S. support for Israel rendered millions of Palestinians homeless, generated endless warfare, and angered Muslims on every continent. Transforming Saudi Arabia into a miniature of Western culture enraged conservative Muslims. Arabs educated at Oxford and Harvard saw through the schemes for plundering their oil. On September 11, 2001, the corporatocracy's dream of oil acquired through the collusion of Islamic surrogates and a proxy army stationed in Israel exploded into a fiery nightmare. Washington's reaction followed a familiar route, one that put the country into greater jeopardy. U.S. military intervention in Afghanistan turned a sympathetic world against us. The invasion of Iraq sent a message that Washington was more interested in securing oil supplies than ferreting out Osama bin Laden. In the longer term, it inflamed already furious Muslim populations, inspired millions to join terrorist cells, highlighted the vulnerability of the U.S. military, and sank the United States into what amounted to bankruptcy. The post-9/11 policies, in fact, were just the last and most obvious in a series of blunders. For every action the corporatocracy claimed as a success, establishing the Shah of Iran, the House of Saud, ruling families in Kuwait and Jordan, and a friendly dictator in Egypt, and supporting Israeli militarism, there had been counterbalancing losses such as the rise of the mullahs, popularity of al-Qaeda, replacement of moderate governments by radical ones, hero worship of martyred suicide bombers, and an escalation in fanaticism. Then Lebanon again was plunged into war, much as it had been shortly after my first visit there. The turmoil began in February 2005, when former Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri was killed in a car bombing in Beirut. His death prompted hysteria and massive street protests. The new government, voted in during democratic elections, appeared powerless to control the strongest faction in the country, Hezbollah, a Shia Islamist organization whose leaders were classified by Washington as terrorists. In the summer of 2006, Israel launched massive airstrikes against Lebanon, destroying parts of Beirut, killing innocent civilians, and cutting the main highway to Syria. Although many world leaders condemned this invasion as an irresponsible attempt to wipe out the Lebanese government, Washington defended Israel's actions. The United States was criticized for once again placing its oil and commercial interests above those of world peace and Middle Eastern stability. Political scientists today marvel at the intransigence of U.S. policymakers, especially in light of similar mistakes during the Vietnam War. The North Vietnamese had proven that the most technically advanced, well-financed military in the world was not invincible. Why, a quarter century later, was it so difficult for the White House, Congress, and Pentagon to comprehend this? Why did so many experienced leaders blunder so terribly? Perhaps the answer revolves around the fact that the corporatocracy reaped immense profits, regardless of all the miscalculations, or, some would say, because of them. The war machine was a financial success, even when it failed militarily. U.S. contractors reaped windfall profits in Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq, as well as in dozens of other places suffering from armed conflicts. For the families of those who died, and for the United States as whole, the cost of these wars was outrageously high. For the corporatocracy, the payoff was huge. The consequences of mistakes in Iraq are far more serious for the future of our country than those in Vietnam. Despite Washington's attempts to convince us that the domino effect was a global threat, Vietnam was essentially a regional conflict. By contrast, the war in Iraq, combined with antagonism throughout the entire area, is a clash of ideologies. It not only pits Christianity and Judaism against Islam, it also is a referendum on the very meaning of consumptive materialism. It may appear that the corporatocracy is winning that referendum in places like Dubai, but all we have to do is flip the television channel to news reports from Iran, Iraq, Egypt, Lebanon, Israel, and Syria to know that Dubai is an anomaly, the illusion of an oasis in the desert. As we approach the end of the first decade of the 2000s, we can only conclude that the corporatocracy has led us into an abyss of historic proportions. Nowhere is this abyss deeper than in Africa.